Jazz is the art of timing. It teaches you when, and according to Wynton Marsalis, that's a truism that works in both music and in life. And it's one of the points he makes in his latest book, Moving to Higher Ground, How Jazz Can Change Your Life. Mr. Marsalis is the artistic director of jazz at Lincoln Center, winner of 9 Grammy Awards, the first person to receive the Pulitzer Prize for jazz composition. And this latest book is published by Random House. I'm very pleased it has brought him back to the show today. Hi.
All right. How you been?
I'm okay. Your title reminds me that we're all relieved that New Orleans was spared the worst of Hurricane Gustav. But were you thinking of your hometown when you came up with the title? Or do you mean to say that jazz is higher ground than other forms of popular music?
Well, we mean higher ground in the sense of how we relate to each other. Not so much a commentary on what other forms of music are, but just what we try to do in our personal lives and what we like to do as people. We're always trying to improve ourselves and get to a higher level.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the case of jazz, you think that jazz is a higher level than other forms of popular music? I know you object to jazz even being paired with pop music.
Well, it's not so much, we don't talk that much about it in relation to other popular musics. We talk about it in terms of its ability to define aspects of American life and music and what the music gives you. It's more a comment on what you receive when you listen to jazz. You know, what you and I were talking about before we got on the air, just prayers and the different musicians. And you were just naming the people that you had seen. And it was evoking for me a feeling, like the feeling of John Coltrane's band or the feeling of Miles Davis's groups or the feeling of Monk. And these are feelings that take you into higher states of consciousness and greater degrees of awareness.
And part of the excitement is also that you never know what a night is going to be like when you go see really good musicians. It's never the same twice.
Right. It's really a lot like life and conversations and the interactions that we have, and that we're always trying to interact with each other with more integrity and get closer to each other and have a better and deeper understanding of each other.
You write that jazz is the principal American art form, and yet its aesthetic remains a mystery to I always say, most people.
Right.
Why do you think that is?
I think one part of it is the intellectual racism that existed for a large part of the 20th century, and the inability to define the music. Like Gilberto Freire wrote a book about Brazilian music. It's called The Masters and the Slaves, and that book caused a revolution in Brazil in the 30s, in which he observed that the samba was an integral part of being Brazilian, and that to be Brazilian meant to be part African. That's why today the Brazilians enjoy their national art. Everyone dances to it, and they don't differentiate by race. In America, we took a different route. We tried to denigrate the music and put it down and made it be kind of an underground thing or a secret or something that was hidden, except for the hippest kind of cognoscenti and people that love the music. And now really is the time where we've made enough strides that we can embrace our national art form and enjoy the fruits of it, because it's such a wonderful music, and it gives us a lot of different avenues to take when it comes to understanding ourselves.
But haven't we had an odd relationship with jazz and black music in general throughout American history? For example, many country singers will talk about growing up listening to the music of the black church. Elvis and any number of others were influenced by Sister Rosetta Tharpe, for example. You had Western swing, which was improvised jazz, but it was music that was really Western music. And we go on and on and on. You know, somebody like Jerry Lee Lewis, I think he probably comes more out of black music than he does out of country music. So, and R&B, rhythm and blues, the Beatles, in the end, was that racism really there?
The racism was not there for the musicians. They're trying to play and learn how to play. A musician is not interested so much in the color of a person that's playing. They're interested in what they're hearing, but it was there in our larger society. That's why we haven't developed the type of education across the entire nation to say these are the American arts. I actually take exception to the putting the term black on music. I always make the point that had I studied with a teacher when I was trying to learn Haydn's music or Beethoven's music, and my teacher would say, well, I'm glad you're here to learn white music today, that would be very odd to me. So I tend to think of the music as American music. And, of course, its roots come from Afro Afro-America. That's one aspect of it, but there are many aspects and tributaries to American music. And the naming of some music, black music, indicates to us the kind of divide that we've had around our music and our arts.
My guest is Wynton Marcellus, who's written, with the help of Jeffrey C. Ward, Moving to High Ground, How Jazz Can Change Your Life. It's published by Random House. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Part of the problem that people have with jazz is that the improvised part, they really don't get how that works. But improvisation has been a part of European musical history as well. Didn't Bach improvise?
Bach improvised. A lot of Baroque masters improvised. Composers improvised, but they didn't improvise together. Like Bach could improvise on the harpsichord. And
was he doing the same thing a jazz musician was doing, improvising on the chord changes?
In that aspect of it, yes. But the jazz musician has a rhythmic imperative that Bach didn't have. We have a set progression, and we improvise in relation to a progression. But also, Bach didn't improvise with other musicians. That's the hallmark of jazz. And that's the democratic part of jazz. We improvise, but we improvise together. So you have to have lightning quick reflexes. You don't know what another person is playing, and you have to make adjustments and stuff on the fly. And the principal thing that guides jazz improvisation, besides musical things like adherence to form and knowledge of harmony and rhythmic understanding of how to execute all these rhythms in time, is a belief in the other person and the desire to play with other people and create with them.
And some of the most exciting moments for jazz fans are when you hear one musician responding to what another musician has done. It's almost like there's a group conversation going on.
Right. That's the thing that we love to do. We love to take up space and leave space. It's the ultimate give back and forth. And also in jazz improvisation, it's a lot like American athletics, the sports. You have a playing field, and you have to execute your rhythms and the things you do in the context of that playing field.
Your father was a jazz musician. Do you think that people who grew up with the music as children of musicians or jazz fans are more likely to understand it than kids who grew up listening to rock and hip hop?
I don't think so. It depends on if they grew up and their parents are jazz musicians and they play jazz. Yes, they have an advantage because they're around the music all the time. But just if you don't ever get into music, I don't think that whether your parents are musicians or not determines what you like.
Or whether you're listening to jazz.
Yeah, a lot of kids of jazz musicians don't even listen to the music.
Uh-huh. Because, there are always kids who rebel against what their parents did.
Either that or they just don't. It doesn't appeal to them. It's not something. So I think that it's very personal. There's so many different types of people that listen to and enjoy jazz, and they come at it from so many different angles that it's impossible to get a profile of the typical, quote-unquote, jazz listener.
It's always interesting to note the people from foreign countries who are interested in jazz. The Japanese musical tradition is totally different from the jazz tradition, and yet Japan provides some of the most fervent jazz fans.
Right, I've never been able to figure that out. That's a mystery.
What about classical music? Do you think someone raised in a family where a lot of classical music was played would be more open to jazz?
I think that, like the way I said before, I think that if you've trained your listening to follow the development or to follow music and follow how themes are developed, you have a better chance of listening to jazz. But I can't say that you don't get that from rock and roll, or you don't get it from hip hop, or you don't get it. It depends on who you are as a listener.
Well, there was a time when jazz musicians also played on rock and roll records. Johnny Griffin, who just died, was on every rock record that came out, R&B record that came out of Cincinnati for about 5 years. John Coltrane played with an R&B band. Many of them did. You went in the other direction. You're one of the few musicians who've developed parallel careers in classical music and jazz.
Right. I grew up playing R&B and funk music. So I was more concerned about what we would do with the jazz tradition and how we would develop our ability to play the music in my generation and leave enough of it for the younger generations to learn. And how can we turn people onto the music in a painless way, not make them feel it's like taking castor oil, because it's such a beautiful music with so many great moments highlighted on recordings, and it creates such a wonderful feeling live. I've been in so many clubs where people just jump up and down and holler and scream, and they're so happy. And the music has such a great, tremendous range from very excited, a great deal of excitement and power to very intimate, tender expressions, that it really accommodates an unbelievable range of people.
Isn't one of the sad things about jazz that maybe some of the greatest performances just disappeared because nobody had recording equipment in the room at the time?
No, that's great for the people who were there. That's part of the specialness of jazz, and it's like the way we live our lives. You never know when you're going to have a kind of special moment or moment in your life. You don't want to always have a film, a camera there to record it. You know, when you'll be just walking through the park holding somebody's hand and something will hit you. Or you don't, when you have kids, you realize you don't know what they're going to remember. So when they tell you something maybe 10 or 15 years later, yeah, you remember when we, you don't realize what is a memorable moment for them.
You're often surprised that it's that thing and not the other thing that you thought would be important to
exactly
them.
That's exactly it. And jazz deals with that because it has so much respect for the individual and the way the individual feels about a given thing.
So since you feel so strongly about jazz, why did you record so much classical music, especially considering that classical trumpet players strive for a very different sound than jazz trumpeters?
I love that music too, and I practiced it a lot. And actually becoming a recording artist in classical music was a fluke. I mean, I didn't even I was playing jazz, and my teacher called me. He was in New York, and he asked me if I wanted to play the Vivaldi 2 trumpet concerto in the church. I said, yeah, I'll play it. I haven't played in a long time, but I'll get my piccolo trumpet out and play. And we played, and it was on the it was on the radio.
And you didn't have to adjust your embouchure?
I think it was on NYC. You have to make adjustments, but then I was 18 or something, 19. You know, you don't think about that. And then someone at CBS Records at that time heard that tape and said, man, I didn't know that you could play classical music. Would you be interested in making a recording? I say, I practiced all these years. I don't mind. We'll see what happens with it.
I wonder if that is in the WNYC archives.
It might be.
That would be a treasure. Why do you think there isn't more of a crossover between the two fields? And I always wondered whether someone like Clifford Brown would have been good playing the classical repertoire because he had such an incredible tone.
It's a different training. It's not what you think. It takes a lot of practice and dedication. It's a different type of attack. It's a different body of music. It's a different approach to phrasing and to learn different styles of music. It's a different experience. It's fun, though. I mean, both are difficult to play, but you have to be dedicated.
Well, we are going to listen to a clip from Haydn's Concerto for the Trumpet in E-flat, which you recorded with the National Philharmonic Orchestra in 1983 now, and go into a break with it.
All right.
Are you going to be impressed by yourself?
No.
That's Jubilo, the Scent of Democracy from Jazz, a ballet you composed for the New York City Ballet. Your own music has found ground that sort of goes back and forth between jazz and classical. But this is not, even though the ballet is called jazz, when you go to iTunes, it comes up as classical. Is there any improvisation in it?
Yeah, there's some movements where we improvise on the one about trains, the saxophone, the piece with two saxophones playing.
Mm-hmm.
We're using the language of jazz. And, of course, it's a ballet, so the moments in the music have to be the same so that the dancers will know what's coming.
When you present it to Peter Martins, what was his response?
He didn't know what it was at first. He said, man, what is this? But it grew on him. You know, and he helped me to develop a lot of techniques and gave me the opportunity to work on my orchestral writing through the ballet, and it was always a great pleasure for me to work with him.
Well, it's something that would be good to dance to. In the end, isn't that what ballet music is all about?
He enjoyed it, but many times it's just, once again, a matter of traditions. Like,
yeah, well, I would think that the first time Stravinsky presented ballet music to a company, they said, what the heck?
Right. It's just a matter of tradition, what you're used to. Can you identify the form? That's part of what we deal with in the book. Moving to higher ground is we give you the names of terminology in the music and things that help you hear it. Because when you don't know really how to listen to it, it can be confusing.
So it's not just important to understand the musical language. We also should understand the language that musicians use to explain what they're doing.
You'll enjoy it more. If you know 12 terms, but it's true of anything.
The 12 term scale?
Don't repeat that one. You know, just if you know some terms, like you know what a bridge is, if you know what the form is, you know that we improvise over a cycle, and you can identify that cycle. It's much easier to listen to the music.
Because then you can follow what the musician is trying to do.
It's exactly like American football or soccer. If you go on American football and you look at soccer, you don't know what they're doing. It's much more difficult to enjoy. And even when you look at a football game, we have analysts who explain the terminology and show you what people are doing. That way it doesn't just look like a bunch of people bunching together and then stopping for 2 or 3 hours.
My guest is Wynton Marsalis. His latest book, Moving to Higher Ground, How Jazz Can Change Your Life, written with Jeffrey C. Ward and published by Random House. This aimed at adults, because you've written books in the past aimed at kids.
It's definitely for adults. And Jeff Ward, the way that we began to write the book is Jeff Ward is the definitive biographer of FDR, and he's written most of Kim Burns' documentaries. He's just a fantastic writer and person and a lover of jazz.
And you met probably when Ken Burns was doing the jazz series.
I think we met before that, mm-hmm. And we became very good friends. I go by his house almost every day. So we're saying, instead of sitting up here talking about this music all the time, let's write a book about the music. So that's the way that that was the genesis of the book. And one of the great pleasures for me working on the book was having an opportunity to work with Jeff on ideas and things that we talk about and what's significant about the music. And it's also interesting because he's not a musician. So he was able to say, people who are not musicians won't necessarily be interested in this, or they will be interested in that. And it enabled us to get a lot of interesting things in the book that listeners of the music can enjoy and learn from.
So you obviously feel there's a need for more jazz education as opposed to even other musical genres.
Well, there's no question about that.
Is it being taught in schools these days?
No, not the way it should be. Not given the weight and the merit of the music and the type of the centrality of it to our culture and our way of life. It is not received anywhere near the attention it deserves, not just as music, but also dance. I really think that the dance is much more important than the music for younger people, for teenagers, for those who want to have levels of romantic engagement and rituals of courtships and things that don't necessarily deal with the exploitation of their sexuality. The possibilities of jazz dance are endless.
But for a long time, jazz was dance music, and that changed with Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie.
Yeah, it was not dance music long enough. it needed to be dance music longer. Not so much the music, because the music that people danced to was still around. It's more the beat, the swing rhythm. And that rhythm has been put on many kinds of music. And I've also had many musicians and friends who say that they went to many dances that Charlie Parker and Dizzy played, and they saw people dancing to that music. It's more a matter of the rhythmic identity of the dance than that period of the kind of 1930s, mid-20s, to 1941 or 42 that we tend to think is the era of jazz dance.
You say that people actually come up to you and ask you, are you making this stuff up?
Right.
That's because they don't understand how improvisation works?
Well, it's hard to understand how it works if you weren't, if you have no education in it and you haven't listened to it. It's complicated. Like I also think about when I didn't like jazz, because my father's a jazz musician. I was always around it, and I would hate to go to their concerts. My brother and I would just run up and down, and we would just, it just sounded like blah, 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 for a long time.
You and both of you are, in fact, all of the Marsalis boys are musicians.
Right. We ended up playing music, but believe me, we didn't like it. Before we became teenagers, jazz was not something that we liked to hear. It was kind of like the mandatory concert you have to go to with the other 30 people who go because your father is playing, and they're going to stand up and play some songs for like 15 or 20 minutes, and you have no idea of what they're playing. And I never lose that sensibility or that understanding when I'm playing for people or when I'm talking to people about jazz. So it's very understandable that you would have trouble coming to grips with the music. And that's why you need a teacher. You need someone to lead you through and say, okay, this is this and this is the other thing. It's something that's natural to all the other things that we, all other tastes that we enjoy.
Well, you get caught in some kind of a bind. On the one hand, some people think that jazz is too difficult to understand. And then you get someone like Allen Ginsberg saying, anybody can play jazz, just pick up a horn and blow.
Right. There's a lot of misconceptions around our music. And we jazz musicians added to that. Because we kind of like the mystique, and it's fun to be mysterious and have a mystique, but it hurts you when you're trying to teach the music.
You say that when your father encountered a new musician, he would always ask the same two questions. Can he play, and how's his time?
Right.
Time is really important. It's not just having chops and being able to play a lot of notes.
Time is the most important thing, because time is what makes people feel good about your playing. It's in the groove. Time you can.
But back to the dancing.
It just the music. Even if people are not on the dance floor, you wanted to dance, and the musicians that are most loved in jazz all had great time.
I know that when something really grabs me, my foot is always going up right. And down, no matter what.
That's definitely your goal, to get that good booty shaking groove. You know, if you that's an objective. It's an objective in jazz and in American music, regardless of if you call it country music, rock and roll, hip-hop, all of those musics in common have the desire to shake a fantail and get to that beat.
My guest is Wynton Marsalis, who's written a book called Moving to Higher Ground, How Jazz Can Change Your Life. It's published by Random House. One of the problems, you say, is that no one seems to be able to agree as to a definition of jazz. Do we even need to have one?
Yeah, we need to establish what the identity of something is, because once again, if you don't know what a thing is, you can't pass it on to anyone. And if something is everything, you're going to have a lot of problems with future generations. And it's interesting that cultures have a lot of music. The Brazilians have a lot of different kinds of music, bossa nova, samba, different forms of pop music. But they're not confused about the difference between bossa nova and samba. They're very clear about what it is, and they consider samba to be the national music. They don't consider bossa nova to be. It is a Brazilian music. And the same thing you could be applied to many cultures. It's important for you to know what your national music is, not in terms of establishing a thou shalt and a thou shalt not, but in terms of saying these are values that are important to us, and we will pass these values on through our music.
Part of the problem with jazz is that it keeps on changing throughout its history. So you have a situation where Cab Calloway calls what Dizzy Gillespie is doing in his band Chinese music. Then later you have the swing musicians objecting to modern jazz. You have modern jazz musicians objecting to what Ornette Coleman does, and on and on and on.
Well, you always have different styles inside of any form, but there are certain principal and primary objectives that are maintained by all of those musicians. Like a musician that played with Cab Calloway's orchestra did play with Dizzy Gillespie. Duke Ellington did play with John Coltrane. Louis Armstrong did play with the whole range of musicians who were younger than him, because there was a common thread that ran through the music, which is the blues and swinging. Once you get away from those fundamentals, regardless of style, you're playing another form of music, which may be a beautiful music. It's not a qualitative statement, but the thing that all the musicians in the different debates they have inside each other about what's good and what's bad, things they do have in common is that common rhythm and the common language of the blues.
Isn't it easier to define the blues because you have a definable musical form there? I mean, there's a sensibility side to the blues, but there's also, blues, 32-bar blues is always the same 32-bar blues.
Right. Well, the blues has an 8-bar form. It has a 12-bar form.
Yeah, but they're all multiples of the same.
But some folk forms of blues have all kind of strange meters and stuff. When you listen to the folk blues, the blues has a sensibility and a sound that we identify because we want to identify it. Jazz has the same thing.
You recently came out with a collaboration with Willie Nelson called Two Men with the Blues. Are most country singers adept at singing the blues, you think?
I don't know about the modern country singers, but someone like Willie Nelson, Ray Charles, musicians who were a certain age during the early 1950s and late 40s, grew up at a point where there was not as much segregation in American music. So you find a musician that can play gospel music, the blues, roots music, folk music. They understand that we're all coming from the same source. Then later, when the different commercial entities got involved in it and created kind of strict segregation between the musics, musicians began to learn music and make choices that took them away from that common ground. Whereas with Willie Nelson and I, some people were saying it seems strange, but I'm from New Orleans, he's from Texas. The songs we play, we grew up listening to and playing, even though I'm much younger than him, it's just root, what I call root music, American music. All of us who grew up in this country at a certain age knew these songs, know this music, and certainly someone from New Orleans would know Basin Street and Stardust and Bright Lights, Big City, and all the grooves that are associated with Caledonia songs like that.
But even going back to the 30s, you have somebody like Jimmy Rogers, the singing brakeman, a white yodeler, who sang the blues and influenced a lot of black musicians.
But he did a recording with Louis Armstrong also. The music was, the musicians were a lot more together, and it was a common objective. Paul Whiteman's father trained black musicians and made it so the Denver school system would remain integrated and not be segregated. And many of our bloodlines, when you study our music, all the bloodlines run together.
And when musicians want to find something to do in an impromptu session, they usually wind up playing a blues.
Oh, you got to play the blues. That's our idea, our calling card. And it's so much fun, and it allows for such a range of expression, and it's natural, which is a natural expression. It's down home and it's sophisticated at the same time.
Well, you're right that it wasn't until you left New Orleans and moved to New York that you really began to understand the blues aesthetic. How did that happen?
Well, in the 70s, we
New York brings out the blues in you?
We didn't respect the blues that much because we were playing more funk music, which has blues elements in it, of course, as all American music does. But we would take a blues and say, that's just the blues, because we were concentrating on trying to learn giant steps and songs with difficult chord changes. Then when I came to New York and had a chance to meet Albert Murray and just listen to the music in my own playing and critique it, I understood that which we thought was very simple and so sophomoric and something that we equated with the pre-civil rights movement and Uncle Tom and all the kind of negative minstrel connotations that came with that, that actually was the essence of the expression that we needed to be developing and understanding and continuing. So that didn't happen until I came to New York. Before, I was in New Orleans, I was more like any kind of teenage kid in the 1970s.
You didn't hear that Louis Armstrong was playing the blues all the time, and because he's one of your heroes.
No, but then he wasn't my hero. I didn't want to listen to Louis Armstrong. Then I was listening to Miles Davis, Clifford Brown, and I felt that their music was a lot different from his, and I always equated him with Uncle Tom and having a handkerchief, singing to a horse, yes, son, and grinning and smiling a lot. And someone from my time, with our afros and right after the Civil Rights Movement, that was the very last thing we were interested in.
Trumpet players have often doubled the singer. Louis Armstrong, a perfect example, Jabbo Smith, Roy Eldridge, Dizzy Gillespie. Why do you think more than other horn players?
Because we play the lead line. And because we play the lead line, we're always playing the melody.
So you're thinking like a singer when you're playing the trumpet?
Right. And we before Dizzy, we would also play very simple rhythms. Like our rhythms would be like di 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 do di 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 We play in that. Where's the clarinetist? Play that. And trombones. Slower rhythms. So we're kind of natural to be the singers.
I'm leading to a vocal you've done.
Wait.
You don't want to play it. My bucket's got a hole in it.
No, let's not hear that.
Okay. Well, then we won't play that. But
Willie put me up to that. I didn't want to do it.
Well, you know.
He put me up to it.
But you do okay.
You can play it, man.
You sing it. No, it's okay. We'll find something. We'll find something that is very much more typical of Wynton Marsalis and the music that he has played with some of his incredible groups, groups that have given jazz so many of its leading musicians. His book, Moving to Higher Ground, How Jazz Can Change Your Life, is published by Random House. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Hey, it's always a pleasure
to see you. Oh, and by the way, Wynton Marsalis will be in conversation with Jeffrey C. Ward tonight. That's September 2nd at 7:30 at the Barnes & Noble store at Lincoln Center. Lincoln Center, appropriately. Thank you again, Wynton.
Thank you very much. I can't buy no beer. Standing on corn. Got my bucket in my hand. Looking for a woman that ain't got no man. But Lord, my bucket's got a hole in it. Lord, my bucket's got a hole in it. My bucket's got a hole.